Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Sam Johnson and Chris Sloan, and they'll be answering your questions on the art of making bamboo fly rods. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Sam and Chris a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You'll also be able to find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share a podcast. And when you do, use the hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and also hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it right now while you're listening to the show. We'd surely appreciate it. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Sam Johnson and Chris Sloan about the art of making bamboo fly rods. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as an unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly, Kodiak, and Bruin rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters around the world. Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. Again, that's BigSkyInflatables.com. Before we introduce Sam and Chris, we'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we will be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at AskAboutFlyFishing.com and look for the link under tonight's section that says register for our free drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a video from Sam and Chris's video training series called How to Make a Bamboo Fly Rod. Now, here's how you can win that video. And this is one video of many that comprise the series, but we'll be giving away just one of those, your choice on which one you want to get later tonight. Now, to win this, you just have to answer the question that I ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something that we, Chris and Sam and I talk about during the show. And the first person that answers it correctly and at the end of the show will win the video. Now, you'll have to submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. The same text box you can ask questions through during the show. So listen closely, take notes, use your best typing skills, and hopefully you'll be the proud winner of the video from the training series, How to Make Bamboo Fly Rods. Our guests tonight are Sam Johnson and Chris Sloan. Sam is a dedicated fly fisher with a deep passion for remote fly fishing and an avid writer about the pristine waters of the Appalachians, Rockies, and Sierras. His expertise and love for the sport extend to his choice of gear, particularly bamboo rods. Sam not only fishes with bamboo rods, but also crafts, collects, and sells them, showcasing his commitment to the art and tradition of fly fishing. In addition to his angling pursuits, Sam is the executive producer and co-host of the popular TV show Wild Bearings Outdoors. This show, which premiered in 2023 on the Country Network, takes viewers on a journey to exotic fly fishing destinations, exploring their history, lore, and angling opportunities. Sam's engaging storytelling and in-depth knowledge bring these locations to life, captivating audiences and fellow anglers. Chris is Sam's business partner in Wild Bearings, co-host of Wild Bearings Outdoors, as well as Sam's number one fishing buddy. He grew up in a small Texas town just a few miles from Lake Louisville, and he grew up bass fishing on Lake Louisville, as well as his uncle's property in East Texas that had a 23-acre lake stocked with huge bass, crappie, and aggressive bream. But it was in 2014, after moving to North Georgia, that he himself became hooked with an even greater passion, fly fishing. He had always been curious about the sport, but it wasn't until he met Sam that the dream of learning how to fly fish became a reality. Since then, he's become an expert at nothing but a pretty good reader of the water he fishes, the entomology that attracts trout, good at finding trout, an innovative fly tire, and a maker of high-end bamboo fly rods. Chris is passionate about the idea of leaving a little something behind others in the sport, like how to make bamboo fly rods. Sam and Chris, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hey, Roger, it's great to be with you tonight.
Yeah, we're looking forward to this. Thank you.
Good, good. Well, I know I've got experts on bamboo here, so I'm ready to learn, and I'm sure everybody else is ready to as well. We don't, you know, I haven't talked about bamboo much on this show. You know, you're always hearing graphite, fiberglass, and all those other ones. But tell me a little bit about, I mean, I read your bios, but tell me how you guys got, you know, or maybe Sam got interested in bamboo rod making, because you've been doing it for quite a long time, right?
Well, a pretty good while, Roger. I fished with a bamboo rod for the first time in about 1996, and I was fishing with a rod from a friend of mine that lives in my area, a guy by the name of Gary Lacey, who just happens to be one of the top bamboo rod makers in the world, in my opinion, and a lot of people's opinion. And I was using his rod, and he said, hey, if you want to make one of these, why don't you just come on over to the shop, and I'll show you how to make a bamboo fly rod. And I was totally hooked from that point forward. Just the processes, the tools, the artistry, and just the nostalgia of taking a piece of grass that grew halfway around the world and turning it into a piece of functional art just really appealed to me, and I've never gotten over it. So that's when I started making bamboo rods about 1997 and been making them, made hundreds and hundreds since. So that's kind of how I got started.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I mean, the first fly rod I ever got was a bamboo fly rod given to me by my great uncle, or was it a great-great uncle, in Chicago, and we were visiting him in his apartment, and we were talking about fishing, and he says, oh, I have this fly rod. Maybe you want to use it. And he says, I don't have any use for it anymore. So that was my first fly rod, too. I found out later it was just kind of run-of-the-mill fly rod, you know, bamboo rod, but it got me started, you know. So,
yeah,
that was my first experience. Unfortunately, it was my last experience with a bamboo fly rod. I haven't had a good one since. But
maybe we can fix that tonight for you.
There we go. Get me interested. Yeah. What makes bamboo a preferred material in your minds for making fly rods, you know, compared to the other materials we always hear about, like graphite, fiberglass, and so forth?
Well, you know, I think for us, Sam kind of hit on it, there's a nostalgic piece to it. But for us, the ability to just to work with your hands and spend time developing something that, you know, you're going to have for 100 years. I think for us, one of the key things that we enjoy about it is Sam, even we have it on some of our shows, is, you know, he's got a 100-year-old bamboo rod that he refinished and repurposed. I think it's a 5'9" weight, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, a 9'5" weight.
Granger.
Yeah, Granger taper, and, you know, 100 years old, and it fishes just as well today, probably better today than it did 100 years ago. So really, you just have the longevity of the material itself. It's not going to break down.
Yeah. Well, you know, from the aesthetic side that Chris is talking about, you know, from the technical side, Roger, and depending on who you ask about bamboo fly rods, what's good about them, better or whatever, it's like religion and politics. You're going to get a different opinion from just about everyone. But what's generally accepted about bamboo, from the superiority of it in some areas, is certainly heavier than graphite and or glass rod. And because of that, it's a little bit slower than those rods are. So you get big loops. It's particularly good for dry fly fishing. On the take, it takes, when you set the hook, it's a little bit slower. I find that you don't jerk bugs out of the trout's mouth quite as often as I do with my graphite rod. And one thing, the last thing I'll mention about bamboo that really doesn't get as much attention as it should is that it has a natural dampening effect. Mm-hmm. The bamboo does. It does not set up a resonation between when it's loaded and when you cast it and it extends out. You don't get any type of vibration on it like you will, in some cases, some graphite or glass rods. So those are a few of the things that we think makes bamboo, you know, a fun rod to fish with. But probably the best one is that if you're standing in a group of 10 guys, they all got a rod, and you're the only one with a bamboo rod, yours is the one everyone wants to see and talk about. So maybe that's the best part of having a bamboo rod.
Yeah, if you like attention drawn to yourself, yeah, yeah. So you already said it's a little slower maybe than the other rods. Can you create the bamboo rods with different types of action?
Yeah, I mean, look, what you can really do is change your line. A lot of times what we'll do is, you know, you want a little bit faster, then you can change and go to put a four-weight line on a five-weight rod, or if you want to slow it down, you can put a heavier line on. But I think for the most part, Sam, I don't know how you feel about it, but for the most part, I don't see much difference in fishing bamboo or my graphite rod, you know. Mm-hmm. I just don't see any.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of people will experience that. You know, from a technical side of the answer, Roger, can you create bamboo rods with different, you know, characteristics? And the answer to that is absolutely, and that's what your taper is all about. And the tapers were the closely guarded secrets of all of the old makers, of some 125 to 150 makers around the turn of the last century. And they all had tapers that were right down to a thousandth of an inch. And that's what really gives the rod, or a particular rod, its casting characteristics. And so anytime someone orders a rod from us, that's always the first decision that has to be made based on the type of fishing they're going to do or have been doing. We help them determine what type of taper we're going to make this rod after. And we have hundreds, we literally have hundreds of tapers from about 25 or 30 different makers over the last 125 years.
Wow. Wow. I didn't realize there was, that many differences in tapers. That's incredible. Now, can you fill us in on a little bit history before we go further? Because this makes me want to think bamboo, I think, you know, Japan, I think China. But yet most of the fly fishing was started over in, you know, England. Was the bamboo rod an invention of the English, or was it an invention of Asians? Where did it originally come from?
Well, that's a really good question. And you asked 10 people that question, you're going to probably get 10 different answers. And, you know, my answer, or our answer, is that the development of the bamboo rod was kind of going on in both continents at the same time. The English, being a colonizing country, were importing bamboo into the islands over there long, long before it came to America, primarily either Soso or Calcutta bamboo from India, that they were experimenting with over there, even though the early rods were made of wood over there also, just like the ones over here. Uh-huh. And in the mid-1800s here in America, we were migrating away from wood to hybrid rods that were both wood and with bamboo tips of anywhere from one to four or five different strips had been glued together. And so I don't know that there's an answer that would be absolutely accepted by everyone about who invented the bamboo rod. I think it was a kind of both countries or both continents were working on it about the same time. And, you know, we took it right up to the embargo of 1950 that we had to quit making them for the most part.
Why is that? Embargo of?
Well, in 1950, the 1950, we had an embargo with China. And at that time, we had switched over from Calcutta bamboo, which we were getting from India, to around the turn of the last century, the late 1890s, we started going to Tonkin bamboo from China. And, of course, when the embargo set in, that put an end to that. other than some contraband that would come in from England, because they were still getting it over there. But that's really, the 1950s is really generally considered the end of the golden age. The 70 or 80 years bamboo rods were really produced in mass. That's when it kind of ended in America, because we didn't have any more bamboo. And about that time, glass was getting good, getting big, and they started making everything out of fiberglass.
Right, right. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Nowadays, they're talking feathers and furs, and there's always something about natural products that gets restricted, it seems, in one way or another. I mean, they're talking about fur restrictions here, at least in Colorado now, for fly tying, you know, so.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, interesting history there. Tell me about, what are some of the key tools and equipment that one would need to start making, you know, their own bamboo fly rods?
Well, you know, probably some of the biggest ones, in our opinion, is that you got a lot of equipment and jigs, such as if you're going to, for instance, saw bamboo, there are a couple of jigs that you need to have to do that correctly, and you need plans to make those, and they're not hard to make, but, you know, you need to know what to do. Planing forms, where you actually set the taper with a gauge or micrometer into your planing form for the taper. Dip tanks and drying racks, binding, glue binding equipment, so that when you glue the strips together, you bind them. Those are some of probably the biggest tools or jigs that we use, Roger, and that anyone that's going to make a bamboo rod, you either need to have access to these things or be prepared to buy them or make them.
How available are they to purchase, or do you find most rod makers do make their own?
Well, that's a great question. A lot of this equipment is available on the market from manufacturers who actually make it and manufacture it. You know, for like rough bevelers, for instance, there are several companies out there that make rough bevelers to put the initial 60-degree angle. Bellinger is just one of those companies, and they've been making them for quite a while, and they do a really good job. So you can go on the Internet, or you can go to company sites and buy a lot of this stuff already made. They deliver it. Or you can buy the plans and make them yourself. Or if you're like a lot of rod makers out there who are very artistic and very creative, they look at the situation, size it up, and by golly, just design it and make it themselves.
Right.
Seems like every rod shop that I've gone in over my career, all of these tools are different in every shop.
Yeah, I noticed my father was he was a fly fisher, but he also built free flight model airplanes.
Yeah.
In fact, he went to the world championships in Yugoslavia to fly his free flight rubber band powered airplane. But anyway, he was always had, you know, whenever he ran into a problem, he would make the jig or the template or whatever he needed, you know, to do that. So I'm still finding things from his workbench that he had made like that for his own purpose, you know, because it was kind of like a one-of-a-kind situation that he needed. So I can see why a lot of people would like doing that as well. That's part of the art, is creating the equipment too. I think that would be interesting.
Well, it certainly is. I mean, it's especially for a maker who really is really good, you know, conceptually and good with her hands. I mean, that's the first thing Chris made when we started making rods together. He built a rough beveler. That's not a simple piece of equipment. And it was a design that I'd never seen before. And it absolutely does as well. It bevels as well as one of the Bellingers that's out there. That's way more expensive and more complex, but you can certainly do it. It's kind of like fly tying. I mean, people really love being able to tie a bug and then go out and fish that bug and catch a fish with the bug they tied. It's kind of a vertical way of looking at it, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think we all get that satisfaction. I mean, I remember the first fish I caught on a fly, you know, because it was that significant to me. I was only in junior high school, but, you know, it's like, yeah, I made that fly and I caught a fish on it. My gosh, this is cool. Yeah, so, when they make the whole thing from you know, rod to fly, then it's even more satisfying, I would think. We need to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to dig into how you guys make your rods, and maybe you can give us some tips and give people an idea of, you know, how involved this whole thing is. So hang tight, and I'll be right back. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming, has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call, and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. Again, it's the uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Sam Johnson and Chris Sloan about the art of making bamboo fly rods. If you'd like to ask Sam and Chris a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. So, yeah, guys, tell me about, you know, I always ask my guests what's going on in your fly fishing world. So you guys got a lot of things going on. So kind of enlighten us as to what your businesses are and how you're involved in the fly fishing world.
Well, we, you know, with Wild Bearings, we started out with, obviously, Sam is an accomplished author writing Fly Fishing the Blue Ridge Parkway, both the North Carolina and Virginia section. And so from that, we took that to build out our online website where we have our books and e-guide on how to get started in fly fishing, our rods. We build rods and sell them online. And we have our own fly business, so we, you know, we sell quite a few flies ourselves. And then there's some art and collectibles that we have on. And, of course, Wild Bearings Outdoors was a spinoff of that. We have our own videos that we've done for years of us just going out and fishing, and people like what they saw. And that's how we kind of got into the network, with the Country Network, and even had some fun with Chad Brock, Country Star, going out and fishing with us and learning how to fly fish. And so there's a number of things. We have some collectibles on there that we do. And so, but primarily that's how we got into this and really just kind of expanded the business in and of itself.
And now taking your craft and, you know, through your new video series, helping others to learn how to make rods, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's really the newest thing we have going, and that's really just a, you know, part and parcel. We're always asked, do you do classes? And,
right.
And we just don't have time to do classes. So mm-hmm. We studied the market, looked what's out there, and came up with what we think is probably a first-in-class offering of how to make a bamboo fly rod with everything you need to make it happen.
Cool, cool. Well, thanks for sharing, guys. You're keeping busy, that's for sure. Yeah, it's like, yeah, if there's a minute of spare time, we seek to fill it, right? And you guys are doing a good job of that. So let's talk about, you had mentioned in some material you sent to me that you guys are making bamboo fly rods differently than maybe other rod builders. You have your own way, your own 8-step process, but in general, what makes, you know, what are the key methods that make your method, you know, different than maybe others?
Well, probably with all the makers that are out there listening to this broadcast, the thing that would probably stick out the most to them that would be different than tradition would be the fact that we saw strips instead of hand split strips. And we do it either way. We just prefer to saw. And there's a lot of reasons we do that. Number one, it's faster. It also saws the tension out of the bamboo. You don't have to straighten it. It planes easier. And we get better efficiency out of a clump of bamboo by sawing it. So, Roger, I have to say, well, the biggest thing would be that we saw.
Okay. Yeah.
Some other thing. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
A few other little things that we do that are different than a lot of people is that when we are unbinding, taking glue off and things like that after the gluing process, we'll take, for instance, our blanks and we'll put them in our refrigerator and we'll refrigerate them for about an hour and chill them down. And what that does is make the glue come off so much easier. And it also scrapes off easier than if at room temperature. We do the same thing before we sand the blanks. And that's one thing that we do that's, you know, that's a little bit different than some of the other people out there. Other things that we do that a lot of the professionals do that the novice builder will not do is that we use metal and wood lathes a lot. Everything from making our grips, making ferrules, and or lapping our ferrules. We don't do any hand lapping of our ferrules, and we do no hand fitting our ferrules onto our blanks. We use a metal lathe to actually machine down that blank to where the ferrule fits on it. And, you know, I know that's not totally revolutionary for a lot of people, but, you know, unless you've got the equipment to do it and you've done it and you're good at it, you know, you just don't see it done that way.
Mm-hmm.
And we make a lot of stuff. We make a lot of hardware. I mean, we can make anything on the rod. And for collector rods or really high-end rods, we don't buy a lot of stuff. It's made and mounted on the rod for that individual client.
Right, right. Well, tell me how you, I don't know if you stumbled upon it or found out from somebody else, but the use of the refrigerator, how did you come across that tip trick of with the glue?
Well, for better or for worse, that was one of my brainstorms. And it took a while before I convinced my previous partner that it was a good thing to do, but it didn't take but about three or four. At the time, we were making a bunch of L.L. Bean rods, and we were turning out about six, in some cases, seven rods a week out of our shop. And we were looking for any way to shave 30 minutes, 45 minutes, 20 minutes out of making a rod. And what we found was that that would cut the cleanup and sanding of those blanks down by about 45 minutes for a three-piece two-tip rod. And I've been doing it ever since. I don't know anyone else that does it, but it's I think it's I really like doing it, and I've been doing it for a while.
Well, what made you stick the rod into the refrigerator in the first place? I mean, it just seems like an odd thing to do. Was there something scientific you had thought about relating to that?
Well, the reason it started is when they quit making Urec 185, which was a binary glue that Lacey Johnson, the first rod company I was involved with, we used Urec, and when they quit, we couldn't get it anymore, we switched over to Titebond 3, and it's a little more tacky. When it dries, we found it didn't sand as well as Urec, or at least it didn't for us. And so the way I solved that problem was actually it was cold in the shop one morning when we came in because we didn't leave the heat on, and it was probably 50 degrees in there. And when I got to work sanding that rod and scraping it, the glue came off so much easier and didn't come up on the sandpaper or on my scraper, and it just kind of dawned on me, well, hell, why not just do this from now on? And that's what we've been doing from now on.
Okay. So now you have dedicated refrigerators in the shop, I'm sure.
It also serves as a beer cooler.
Beer cooler, yeah, of course. okay, yeah. All right, well, let's talk about your eight-step process. Let's kind of walk through that as best we can. Of course, you know, we're not going to cover all the details that you have in your training course. And of course, we don't have any images here tonight. But let's try to give people, especially people that are listening and thinking, hey, I might want to make a bamboo rod, but I've never done it before. I really don't know what's involved in it. So give us enough information to kind of wet the whistle of some of these folks in thinking about doing this. So, you know, start with step one. And I think in that, you're determining, you know, what taper and what material to use, right? So why is that taper so crucial to the rod's performance? I mean, you've already mentioned it a little bit earlier, but why don't you go into that a little bit more?
Well, Roger, the taper of a rod is every bit should be considered the DNA of the rod. It's kind of how we describe it to a client. It's everything. In fact, you can be the most beautiful rod maker in the world, aesthetically, visually, but have a lousy taper, and it's a piece of junk, even though it looks good. But you can have a great taper with mediocre construction technique, kind of a rod that's not that pretty, but it's got a great taper and it's planed well, and it'll cast like a champ, and you'll love it for that. So the taper is really, it's truly, in our opinion, the most important part of the bamboo rod. And we help the client, if the client doesn't know, sometimes they'll come to us and say, hey, I want a Granger 8050. They know exactly what they want. Most of the times they come to us and they just want to talk about bamboo rods and why they're good and why they think they want one. And we find out where they fish, what kind of creeks, rivers, streams, lakes they fish on, what size fish they're catching, and what they've been using to catch those fish with. And then we back into what would the right taper be to emulate the type of fishing they want to do. And then we'll give them several choices. And we, generally speaking, almost exclusively, we go with historic makers. I mean, the Paynes, the F.E. Thomases, the Grangers, those types of tapers. Probably 90% of the rods we make come from about 6 or 8 different tapers. And we've got probably another 30 different makers with tapers that we could pick from, too. But we help them pick that taper out. And once we have the taper, Roger, the rest is pretty easy because that goes into the form, the planing form, and that's what will determine that casting characteristics of that rod. So that's why the taper is so important. We spend a lot of time making sure that's right. And then the bamboo, of course, we only use talking bamboo. And people say, well, you know, I've got some bamboo in my backyard that looks just like that. Well, you probably do. I mean, talking bamboo grows all over the country. But the problem is it doesn't have the power fiber that this bamboo that we're getting from China has. So you could make a rod out of that bamboo, and it would look just like a rod that came from Wild Bearings, but it would fish like a wet noodle because it would not have any backbone to it. So the bamboo that we use, we have a special place we order it from with a couple of other makers. We import it, have it kiln dried and infused with ammonia to darken it up. The makers that are going to, for instance, that would do our series, they're going to order bamboo from several different sources that we provide, that they'll go online and shop the bamboo sources and order their clump of bamboo and when they get it in. And then at that point, it's just a matter of really looking at that bamboo, making sure it's not, doesn't have any worms or blotches or mold or mildew, doesn't have leaf nodes that are going to mess up the aesthetics, and that it's not overly crooked. And that's what you want to make sure of when you're ordering bamboo. So step one is all about getting the right bamboo and making sure you got the right taper. And once you do that, you're ready to start making a rod with step two.
Now, the suppliers that you have for the bamboo, are they specifically cutting and treating and drying this bamboo for fly rods, or is it being used for other purposes as well?
The ones that we're recommending that we put on our supply list are just for bamboo fly rod makers. Now, there are some other suppliers out there that you can buy Tonkin bamboo from that are, you know, they don't know what a bamboo rod is, but if you know what you're looking for and you can shop their site or their location, you can get some really good bamboo at some really good pricing.
Now, is it recommended that you go directly to a Chinese supplier to get this, or are there U.S. distributors or distributors in England or other places that act as intermediaries?
These are all U.S. suppliers that have either imported directly and then they redistribute. You don't necessarily want to get into importing your own bamboo. We tried that a couple of times back in the early 2000s, and it didn't take us but about 2 containers to realize that was a big mistake.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I've done some importing myself, and it's not a simple process. I'm riddled with all kinds of issues and problems in between.
You better have an agent over there that's your one of your relatives, you know. And, and even then, you may not get what you order.
There was a question from Terry Little in Roanoke, Virginia. He says, is there another source of good bamboo other than China, and how difficult is it to obtain? How do you ID Tonkin bamboo from other varieties?
Well, you know, there are some defining characteristics. To answer Terry's question, there may be, Terry, but I don't know where it would be. I know where this bamboo comes from that we order. It comes about 100 miles northwest of Canton, which is in the northern Gulf of Tonkin Bay area, up in a mountain range. It's about, I think, 25 square miles up there that this stuff grows in, up in the mountain passes, and blows back and forth and puts on the extra power fiber, grows to about, you know, 40, 50 feet. Then they cut it and take it down, I think, to the Sewer River, and they straighten it on the banks. A lot of them will straighten it, which can be problematic, too, because they scorch it when they do that. And then they'll bundle it up and float it down the river and get it over here. But the original Calcutta bamboo came from India and a few other closer countries over there. But I don't know any other places that the Tonkin bamboo that, like, we get with the thick walls that we get, any place other than China at this time. If someone else does know that, I'd love to know it.
Well, if it's not broke, don't fix it, right? You got a good source, a good product, and it keeps coming, then why change, too? But isn't that interesting? Right. There's so many things around the world that are, like, only available in one spot, you know? And I just find that really interesting. Here we go with, and bamboo's all over the world, but like you said, this particular bamboo has certain properties that make it special. So,
They really do. You know, I'm up in Asheville, North Carolina, quite a bit, demonstrating bamboo rod making at the National Park Service's location at the Folk Art Center. And people are always bringing in bamboo. They're bringing in, you know, a half a clump of bamboo or a couple of feet of it, you know, and actually most of the time it's Tonkin bamboo. But when I show them the difference, a cross-section of theirs and a cross-section of ours, is the light goes off and they get it, because it's the Tonkin we've got has three or four times as much power fiber as the bamboo that grows in Asheville and even down in this market, in the Atlanta market, North Georgia market, where I am in Chris.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. It's, you know, here in Colorado, we have at the high altitudes bristlecone pine. And generally, when people think of bristlecone pine, it's above timberline and it's, you know, in bonsai form, you know, I like to say, because it's weathered and, you know, the wind and the snow and everything shapes the tree. And we discovered last year or a year before last when we were camping, we found some bristlecone pines. But then we found on the other side of the mountain where bristlecone pines were growing that weren't affected by the weather. They were protected. And they were like different trees altogether, just on the other side of the hill. So that just makes me think of what you're describing as, the environmental, the water, the wind, the elevation all have to do with creating this one kind, this special kind of Tonkin bamboo. So, yeah, I've kind of seen in another way, I've seen that same tree, but growing quite differently up here in Colorado. Listen, we need to take another break. Go ahead. Did you want to finish something there?
Yeah, I've never really thought about that, Roger, but you're exactly right. That's another way of thinking about why this bamboo thickens up the way it does. But the trees on the windward and leeward side of mountains do the same thing. That's a good point you made.
Yeah. Well, let's take another quick break, and then we'll get into step two and move right along here. So hang tight, guys, and we'll be right back. Discover the power of pure Skagit and Olympic Peninsula Skagit tactics. From delicate soft hackles to heavy steelhead flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled Skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques. Whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead, trout, or smallmouth bass, Trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit PierceGadget.com or call them at 209-858-8476. Again, that's PierceGadget.com or call them at 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Sam Johnson and Chris Sloan about the art of making bamboo fly rods. If you'd like to ask Sam or Chris a question, just go to our homepage, fill out the form, send it in, and we'll try to get an answer tonight on the show. And, yeah, guys, I do have a question that came in here on the Internet from Jeff Archiburn in La Cruces, New Mexico. He says, I have a couple of two-piece 7-foot, 6-inch bamboo rods that I love, and I prefer the feel of them over 3-piece rods. Of course, the rod tubes are longer and less convenient. What do you think is the ideal configuration for a trout rod?
Well, I think that's just personal preference. You know, there's sometimes we have 2-piece, but most of the time we have 3-piece. So really, it's just a preference as to what you like. I mean, obviously a 3-piece rod is going to have just a little bit more hardware on it. It's going to be a little bit, just a tad heavier by a few grams, but you know, that's the way we look at it. Hey, I've got a custom 4-piece, 8-foot, 5-weight that Sam made for me, and it's pretty dang cool because you can pack in with it in a small tube. And so, again, it's just personal preference.
Yeah, I would agree with that, you know, for the caller. You know, what I don't know that there's an optimal configuration except for the person who's fishing with it. You know, I fish a lot of small streams, so a 7-foot rod for me is typically what I go with, you know, probably a 3-weight. And normally, instead of a 2-piece, it's a 3-piece rod. And I do that because it packs well. I can throw it in my pack. I can throw it in an overhead if I'm going out west, and it's just convenient. So
I'll tell you another thing, that it's also regional. And, you know, in the southeast, we got pretty heavy canopies that are over our streams. And so a lot of times we're going to go with a little bit shorter rod. And, again, you know, it could be a 2-piece or a 3-piece, but a lot of times, you know, we're fishing 7-foot rod just because, you know, the nature of the environment that we fish in. You go out even all the way from a hook set, you know, we tend to have to hook set at more of a horizontal. We can't necessarily go straight up on a hook set in the southeast, or, you know, Roger, you know where your bugs are going to be?
Yeah.
They're going to be in the trees, you know. So, yeah. Again, I think it's just a personal preference. And in fact, I was just up fishing on the Conasauga River up in North Georgia, and I thought, you know, I think I'm going to build a 2-piece rod. So, I am. I'm going to build a 2-piece rod, probably about a 6.5-foot 2-piece rod.
Okay. Is there any performance difference, you know, from 2 to 3-piece to 4-piece that is discernible?
I don't think so, but people, I promise you, people would argue to the death with that statement. just about like everything else we're talking about tonight, somebody will want to kill us, you know, because that's not the way they do it or the way they believe it. Probably from a scientific standpoint, with these tapers, you know, the more ferrules and stations you put on the rod, you know, it affects the original taper as it was designed. And so that's the reason a lot of, you know, 7-foot rods and shorter, you know, you only have one set of ferrules on there. You don't have, it's a 2-piece rod, not a 3-piece rod. And that keeps it truer to its, you know, to its original taper.
Going back to tapers again, because you just reminded me of a question I wanted to ask earlier. You had mentioned all these, you know, historical tapers and so forth. Are the specifications for these readily accessible to the public? Are they trademarked? What's the access like to these?
Yeah, access is very easy. Just go to Google and type in fly rod tapers, and there's all kinds of websites that are going to have as many tapers that you want. And I don't know about proprietary at this stage, because I think a lot of the tapers are, they're old. And some of these companies aren't even around anymore.
I bet.
The majority of them are not. They're owned, you know, like Granger was bought by Wright and McGill. Wright and McGill own all of the original Granger tapers and patents and everything else. And when Gary Lacy and I were making those rods, they granted us permission to use all of those tapers. And I've got a library of every Granger taper there is out there.
Wow.
Along with some of the original patents for the real seats. That I've got in my database. But anyone that's wanting to find a taper, basically all you got to do is go out there and just Google it, and you'll be covered up with tapers.
more than you can ever want.
Yeah, almost any maker you want.
I think the main thing you're going to look for, you know, when you Google, and this will come up, is understanding how to read the power curve. And that's probably one of the more challenging components of this, is understanding. You're going to see these graphs and how these power curves are laid out, and that really starts to demonstrate how the butt, the mid, and the tip sections are going to respond, you know, to each of the specific rod makers' tapers that they came up with. That, you know, we talk about the 80-50 quite a bit. That goes all the way back to Granger and dry fly fishing. I mean, he was a competition caster. And a lot of these tapers came from that era, and he was, you know, winning championships with his casting. That's why we kind of settled, for the most part, on an 80-50, because you put a dry fly on the end of that sucker, and you're going to be able to cast it a mile. You will feel like a river runs through it. You're going to actually look better than what you really are. But that 80-50 taper is just beautiful. You know, part of what we talked about earlier, you know, what makes a difference with a bamboo rod, and I'm going to tell you, that bug, that dry fly on the end of that bamboo rod, when it settles in to land on the water, it's going to look about as authentic as you can get. And that's part of the beauty of fishing with bamboo, I think.
Okay. Well, let's move on to step two, which is the preparation of the bamboo itself. I wrote down a couple notes here, because you did say earlier you do split and saw, but I guess you prefer to saw. So maybe you can address that and take us through step two.
Well, part of the sawing is, I mean, if you think about it, Sam, at the time, you know, we have a lot of jigs and stuff that we've created. And part of that has been, you know, when Sam was making hundreds of rods a year, you don't have a whole lot of time. It still takes, you know, as good as you can get and as proficient as you can get. What, 32 hours, I think, was about the best that you could get on making a bamboo rod. And so if you're having to hand split, well, that just takes a lot more time. So the sawing that we like is that you're going to get more yield out of a comb of bamboo. And so that's primarily why we choose it. And, you know, you're spending less time on straightening and sitting over a candle trying to get the, you know, the curves out of your rod.
That was the biggest motivator for me, is that after I'd straightened about maybe strips for about 10 or 12 rods, the first rods I made, I learned to hate straightening strips. I was determined to find some way not to have to use an alcohol lamp or a heat gun or a steam press. We use steam presses to straighten those strips. But, you know, all in all, when it was all over and done with, when it comes, the difference between sawing and hand splitting and straightening is that from starting at, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I could have a three-piece two-tip rod in the string hanging and drying in the cabinet with the bounding glued. And that's everything from prepping that bamboo, sawing it into strips, setting the stagger on it, planing the strips out, then gluing them, binding them, and putting them in a dryer in less than 8 hours for a three-piece two-tip rod. And there's no way I could do that hand splitting and straightening over an alcohol lamp.
Can you, I'm assuming sawing is pretty straightforward. You probably have a table saw or something that you're running these through with jigs.
Band saw. Yeah.
And And then what's the difference? What is actually involved in hand splitting if one were to do that?
Well, hand splitting, you'll use a wooden mallet, which we've got, and something like a small piece of 2x4 in a vise, along with a knife, and in fact, a dull knife, but with a really sharp point. And then we take the piece of bamboo, the quarter piece of a bamboo that we prep. We have taken a file and taken the nodes off the outside of it, and we've taken a gouge, a radius edge wood gouge, knock the dams out of the center so it's perfectly clean, and then we'll put it down on that rounded top 2x4, take our sharp edge and our wooden mallet, and we will drive it through one end of the bamboo, and then we will hold that bamboo with two hands and push it against that blade, twisting it in whatever direction we need to twist it to keep the split going straight down through the power fiber. Hmm. So that we'll mark it off first. We'll take our gauge, depending on whether it's a butt, mid, or tip section, and we'll take a Sharpie and put a little dot on the end of that bamboo. And typically on a quarter piece of bamboo, there'll be about 5 dots, which would be enough for 6 strips. And then we'll strip them out that way. And it's easy to do. It's hard to learn to do good. It takes a while, yeah. And you waste a lot of bamboo, or at least I wasted a lot of bamboo. And I had a master maker teaching me, and I trashed a lot of bamboo until I learned how to split. And then I migrated to sawing. I rarely split anymore.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, from your description, it just sounds like it would take a lot of practice to do the splitting, whereas sawing, you could maybe get it right the first few times or so because you've mm-hmm. got less chance of it going its own direction, so to speak. I don't know if I'm well, on target there or not. But
well, Roger, you're almost right there. The sawing has its own unique idiosyncrasies.
Okay.
And because we line off the bamboo, we have a special jig that we actually line it off where you saw down the lines. And when you are sawing using this jig, you can't be listening to music. You can't be talking with anyone. You can't be smoking a cigar or drinking a beer. You can't be thinking about where you want to go out to eat tonight. You have to focus on the point of contact between the blade and the line that's on that bamboo. And if you think about anything else, I promise you, you'll get off that line. So it just takes a technique to get used to it and to learn it. But once you learn it, you can saw out 24 strips of bamboo in about 45 minutes.
We do not discriminate. We like all approaches, all types of, even though we get discriminated against.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I think it's sexy splitting bamboo and hand straightening and everything like that. I think it's great.
Yeah.
I just don't want to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And people get really upset with us because they say, well, you know, this is not traditional what you're doing. Well, you know, working in an air conditioning shop's not traditional either.
Right.
You know, things have changed and we've changed with the times, but there's a lot of technical arguments, you know, for sawing and splitting. And we don't have time to go through all, get into that tonight. But I guarantee you, I can make my point with the best of them as
okay.
to why sawing is absolutely good.
Okay. Need to take another quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll finish up these steps. So hang tight. Be right back. Fly Fishers International needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. The organization provides grants to help with the restoration of habitats like Wolf Creek in Idaho and Sands Creek in Delaware County, New York, and funds projects that collect valuable data about fish and their habitats like the Peacock Bass Study in Miami, Florida. FFI serves as a strong advocate for fly fishing in all waters for all fish to preserve and promote the arts of fly casting and fly tying, and to help ensure future generations can continue to enjoy these one-of-a-kind experiences. These efforts won't be nearly as effective without your help. If you're not already a member, we invite you to join Fly Fishers International as they work to cultivate conservation, education, and community within the sport of fly fishing. Join Fly Fishers International today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to their website at flyfishersinternational.org. Again, that's flyfishersinternational.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Sam Johnson and Chris Sloan about the art of making bamboo rods. If you'd like to ask Sam or Chris a question, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and fill out that form, and we'll try to get it answered on the show tonight. Okay, step three. What happens in step three, guys?
Well, we're going to start the process of rough beveling. So now we got our strips, and as Sam mentioned a minute ago, you know, we created our own rough beveler. You can find ours is a Baczynski-style beveler that uses sandpaper, and that's going to put that initial 60-degree that you're looking for on your strips. So we start the rough beveling process, and then from there we start to get ready to plane the strips.
And, Roger, that's what, you know, when most people think of making bamboo rods, the primary thing they think about when they think about making a rod is planing.
Yeah.
And creating all that beautiful little curly bamboo, curlicue dust from that. But that's a huge part of making a rod is the planing process.
How critical is the position?
I'm sorry, Roger. It's very precise.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the things we show in our how to make a bamboo fly rod is how to use the planes, what type of planes you need to have, and then how do you approach your forms, your planing forms with the bamboo. And so just really specific techniques on how to get the most. I remember the first time I planed a rod, and if you don't do it right, you're going to end up with some pretty massive glue lines. So it is important to be very precise and very specific. And understand, too, that as you go through the process, some of the, if you get a little fat on some of your strips, it's okay because you're going to be doing a few more techniques in steps 4 and 5 that are going to start to really fine-tune the look and the feel and making sure that you're within the right specs of your taper.
So step 4 is the gluing process then?
That's right. That's where we take the 6 strips of each section and we have them taped together the way that they're going to be when they're finished. And we lay them down on a bench, and we take an X-Acto knife, and we slit that tape and butterfly them open, and we paint the inside of it with our glue. And then we roll them back together, and then we have a binder that counter-wraps the blank. As you crank it through, it spirals the string on it with just the right amount of tension, and then you run it through a second time, and it counter-wraps it. And so it has equal tension all the way around, and then we take it, clean it up a little bit, make sure it's straight, and hang it in the drying cabinet. Or in most cases for us, we'll let it dry 24 hours. And then it's ready to take out and in step 5 and clean up.
Now, I have my notes here that you glue the strips onto a blank or into a blank. Am I remember that wrong, or can you explain that to me?
Yeah, but when we use the term blank in bamboo fly rod making, that is a section of the bamboo, the unfinished section of a bamboo rod with no snake guides, no ferrules, no nothing on it. It's just the bamboo for one of the sections.
Oh, okay. Okay, I gotcha.
For like a 3-piece, 2-tip rod, you would have 4 blanks. You'd have 2-tip blanks, a mid blank, and a butt blank.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And each one of those would be made of 6 strips of bamboo.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay. Then step 5, tell us about step 5. And this is where the ferrules come in the place of putting them onto the blanks, I take it?
It's in this step. The first thing we have to do is take it out of the string that it was bound in when it was dried and clean it up. Have to get all the glue off of it, the residual glue from the gluing process. One of the things we do different than a lot of other people, again, refrigerate it. But the last thing we do after we have filed it is that we take an X-Acto blade and we scrape each facet of the hexagon on all four sections, and it polishes it up and just makes it beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And then
after that, Roger, you're right, the ferrules come next, and we take those and we either make those or we buy them depending on the rod that we're making. And this is when you prep and lap the ferrules to where they fit together. Because typically when you buy ferrules, they're not lapped. They're not fitted to where, you know, the male will go inside the female. You're going to have to lap those down several thousandths of an inch in order to get that fit. And that fit will be within a quarter to a half a thousandths of an inch. It'll be so tight. So when you pull them apart, you get that nice little snap sound because it's actually pulling a vacuum. And so we take our metal lathe and we lap our ferrules and prep them. And then we take each of our four blanks for the rod. If it's a three-piece two-tip rod, we actually lay them down. We have a jig we lay them on and decide where we're going to cut them into their final lengths. And we get that done. And that's kind of a gutsy thing to do the first time you do it because it's easy to mess it up. So you really need someone looking over your shoulder or someone telling you exactly how to do that. And then once they're cut in step five, the last thing in step five is to mount the ferrules. And we do that, again, with a metal lathe. We take each blank, put in the metal lathe, and actually turn down the end to be a mirror of the ferrule that we're mounting on it. And it is a perfect fit. And when you do that, opposed to using a hand file and filing it by hand, like a lot of people do, and that's, I just don't think you can get as good a fit. I can't get as good a fit without using a lathe like that. And that's step five. There's a lot of moving parts in step five.
In that step five, yeah. We did get a question.
Here's what we know. You know, Roger, here's what we know in step five, too, is we've done this. We've gotten a little too deep into the bamboo fibers, and we get out on the water, and we've snapped a rod, snapped the butt section. So you can do that. You mentioned a minute ago about being precise.
Right.
And this is part of that precision. We really just have to, the ferrules and everything, you just have to take your time.
Yep.
And get it exactly where it needs to be. And we got mics that we're using all the time just to make sure that, you know, we're within our tolerances that we need to be in.
I got a question coming on the internet from Phil in Kentucky. He says, I have an old Montague three-piece rod and wonder how to determine when the ferrules are properly seated without exerting too much force.
The Montague ferrules, you know, are lying. When you seat them, it should be obvious that they're fully seated. Or you can lay them next to each other also to see where the depths are, you know, how deep it should be going, and mark it and then seat it. I would make sure, too, that they're properly lubricated. And by lubricated, I mean just a little bit of body oil is the only thing we ever recommend. We're still pretty old-fashioned on that kind of stuff. Take a little bit of off the side of your nose or behind your ear and rub on the male and then fit it in there. Don't use anything else. I guess some people do, but we never have. That's the way we were taught. That's the way we do it. Those ferrules, if they're lapped properly, they haven't been stressed or they haven't been put together dirty to where the male has scratched the inside of the female and vice versa, they should seat properly. And I guess my big test about ferrules, are they working correctly, is that when you pull them apart, are you getting that are you pulling a vacuum? Are you getting that little snap, that little pop when they come apart? If you are, more than likely, you know, they're good enough shape you should be able to fish them.
Kind of like when you were a kid and you put your finger in your mouth and you pop pop your lip, you
right.
know, or you pop the side of your mouth. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah. It's funny because, Sam, the way you describe it, I learned the little greasing from my grandfather, you know.
Yeah.
And but he always had more grease on his nose than I did as a kid, you know.
Yeah.
So it worked better for him.
Hey, I bet his ferrules fit together good, too.
Oh, yeah. Very good, yeah. Phil had another question about his Montague Sunbeam rod. He says that he likes to fish with. He says it has a set And this can kind of lead us, I think, into step six. Should he just fish it, or can he attempt to remove the set? Is there an effective way to remove the set without heating the rod?
Well, I mean, the bigger question here is how big a set is it? You know, how much set is there in there? If it's minor, well, I mean, for me, I'd fix it. I mean, but if he doesn't want to fix it and it's just a minor set, just fish it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the length you're talking about and the weight you're talking about, I just don't think it's going to affect your cast that much. But that rod, if it's in good shape, if the varnish is in good shape, that rod was probably made somewhere between 1930 and 1950. So it could be, it's probably more than likely a hide glue if it's the earlier part of that. It's not going to hurt it to use a hair dryer to warm it up a little bit. And by warm up, I mean don't warm it up any more than you'd be comfortable touching. And get it warm, rotating it around, or get it warm all the way around, and then flex it and let it cool, overflex it so that when you let go, it'll come back straight again. And you'll have to play with that a little bit. But if it has not delaminated and the varnish is in good shape, and otherwise it's in good shape, I by all means would get your wife's hair dryer and heat that sucker up and straighten it out.
Okay. So that leads us into step six of assembling and straightening the rod. So tell us about how that takes place.
Yeah, no, we in step six, when we start to, you know, put this together, we're trying to find that spine on the rod, right, that we're going to align our snake guides properly. And we're going to start really starting to dress this rod out and get it ready for, you know, getting our hardware to put on the rod. And so, you know, I think the straightening process for us, again, going back to how we, you know, saw the bamboo, we typically in this step don't find ourselves having to worry too much about straightening a rod.
You know, Chris, Roger's going to get emails and text and smoke signals and probably incoming stuff about this statement I'm getting ready to make. But quite frankly, we rarely are able to find a very defined spine on the rods we make.
Yeah.
And the reason being is because when we saw, we're sawing the tension out of that strip of bamboo, and it's straight as an arrow when it comes off the jig. And so when we glue it together, there's no tension that's glued into the rod. So the spine, when we're rotating this rod on the bench looking for the spine, it's rare. And I mean,
it's hard.
I know you agree.
Yeah.
It's rare that it'll pop into position and say, well, holy crap, there's a spine.
Yeah.
I haven't seen one of those in a long time. But generally, we always check for spine, but it's rare that we find a very defined spine. And that goes right into the straightening also. Once we get the ferrules and everything on there and get it mounted, and put the rod together and we sight it for the first time, it's rare that we have to do any straightening. And if we do, we do it just like we told the caller.
Right.
We take a heat gun, heat it up, and real quickly, it's ready to go.
Okay, good. Yeah, and Phil says thanks. He wrote in he's going to give it a try with the hairdryer to remove that set. So then seven. We're running out of time, guys, so we're going to have to move along here. And I have seven. Wrapping and finishing steps.
Well, you know, Roger, this is where it starts. This is the wrapping, the rod. This is, other than planing, this is where most people really bog down and get frustrated. But putting the winding check on is nothing. Prepping the ferrules for the wrapping is just getting the extra glue off that you put on, you know, when you've mounted the ferrules. And then wrapping the rod is an involved process, but it's repetitious. Once you learn to do it, it's just a matter of just taking the time and going through each station and mounting it on there on the spine, especially if it's a defined spine, and getting your stations on there with silk thread that you're not doing any overwrap. You're packing it properly, and then very importantly, color preserving that silk thread with a color preserver so that when you dip it, you're not going to change the color of that wrap. The only other thing I'll say about wrapping is if for the first time, if you're doing a rod for the first or second, third time, keep your wrap simple. you know, don't get too complex and too bodacious with your routes, because you're just going to frustrate you. It's going to take you forever. Just do a simple one or two color route and let it go at that. You'll be much happier.
Okay. And then we're down to the last step in your series, and this is putting on the final finish, I guess. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, this is probably one of the more technical, challenging pieces of finishing a rod out, and that is just getting that nice varnish finish on your rod. And, you know, you have to have a dip tank. I mean, you could brush it on, but you're not going to get the same effect. But having a dip tank, which is, you know, pretty simple to build, what we have found is making sure that you have the right motor coming, you know, warming your varnish. So our dip tanks, mine has heating pads on it that I turn on to get that varnish nice and warm, and then having revolution per minute.
Yeah, it's just about 1.5 inches per minute.
Yeah.
It extracts the blank out of the varnish.
And if you pull it right and you get that correct, then, you know, it's going to lay down on the rod and you're not going to have runs and the drips. And that's probably one of the most challenging pieces of this.
Right. We stop the extraction process after each route, right under each wrap, and we let the surface tension of the varnish in the tank pull the excess off the bottom of the wrap. And that's a lesson learned many, many years ago to keep you from having a sag right under each of the wraps. It makes it sand better, it's aesthetically more pleasing. And the other thing is heating the varnish that Chris mentioned. A lot of people thin the varnish on their first couple of dips, at least the first couple of dips. We just heat it. And then we may cut it again later. You know, the more you heat it, you'll cook off some of your stuff in there, and we replenish that. But we just find that the warmer varnish goes on slicker, and then we spend an inordinate amount of time, Roger, keeping dust and bugs and everything else out of the shop, because dust is your biggest enemy when you're dipping a rod.
Yeah, makes sense.
And I think the other thing is, don't cheap out on your varnish.
Yeah.
You get cheap varnish, you're going to get a cheap finish.
Exactly.
Okay. I've got three questions from our listeners that I want to cover before we finish up, even though we're running over here, but I want to make sure their questions get answered. Manfred in Roscoe, New York says, how do you remove old varnish from a bamboo fly rod?
Well, our favorite, depending on what condition the varnish is in, we either scrape it or we sand it. We don't like chemicals, although there are some chemicals that if you're careful and you're not going to let it seep down in the glue and get in the joints and maybe make your glue weaker. Some people use steel wool. The problem with steel wool, if you're not careful, you'll round off your hexagons and take the sharpness off the corner of the hexagon. So we scrape, and we have various numbers of types of scrapers we use. And then we use various grits of sandpaper from about 800 up to 3,000 to get the rest of it off.
It's actually kind of fun. I mean, a lot of times we'll just use a really good sharp X-Acto blade and just start taking it down.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that.
Depending on the shape of the varnish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jerry in Lexington, Kentucky says, what are the qualities a buyer needs to look for when purchasing a bamboo rod? And with so many independent makers, how does a buyer select a quality rod?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the thing to look for in a rod is, you know, the true thing to look for in a rod is, how does it cast? You know, does it cast well based on your experience with rods? Does it feel like a quality rod? Does it feel special to you? Aesthetically, what shape is the varnish in? Is there any delamination going on any of the sections? Do you have any twist or sets in any of the sections? The hardware, is it in good operating shape? If you're having a rod made from someone, you know, what's the reputation of that maker? Have they been making rods for a while? Have you seen a rod that they've actually done? What kind of taper is it? I mean, that's generally, you know, when I'm looking at a rod, I'm going to buy a rod that's not one of my rods. First thing I want to do is cast it. I don't care who made it or what it looks like. If it doesn't cast good, it's not a good rod, in my opinion.
Okay, okay. And lastly, Chuck in Placerville, California, he says, all rods over time, irrespective of the material used, possible breakage can occur. I'm sure that this is the case with a bamboo fly rod also. What are the recommendations to extend the life of a bamboo fly rod?
Well, first of all, most of the breakage that you see is because you got the tip hung in a door, you know, so getting in and out. But, you know, we disassemble the rod and we wipe it down each time before we put it back in its tube. And that in and of itself, just wiping the grease and the water and the moisture off of your rod is going to really help preserve the life of that rod.
Drying it before you put it up, especially if you're putting it in a tube, is really important. Don't overfish the rod. And by that, we mean don't fish an 8 foot five weight, you know, trying to go after a steelhead. You know?
Right.
And I mean, within reason, although you can land big fish with a smaller rod, you're going to stress the stations and eventually you're going to see it where the things start to turn loose. Hot and cold, if you're not comfortable, your rod is not comfortable. So don't keep it in an excessively hot place or cold place. Doors, ceiling fans, and strangers. If someone says, wow, that's a great rod, can I see it? You better make sure when you hand it to them that there's not a ceiling over their head or a ceiling fan or something they're going to jam it into. And probably the last thing, Roger, for this caller, is that when you want your rod to last, when you're walking through the forest or you're walking along that riverbank, turn your rod around and face it backwards and put and carry your reel forward. Because when people send rods back to us that have broken tips, about half the time they were walking along the river or the creek, checking out the fish in the creek and let their tip get down in the dirt and it snaps it off. And that's going to cost you about $800 at Wild Berries.
When I was probably in fifth or sixth grade, and we were living in Alaska, in Anchorage, Alaska, and we were going fishing, and we had to get to this where we wanted to fish on this river. We were walking down railroad tracks with our parents, and my dad told me, he says, now, you know, I want you to watch your rod. If you break that tip off, you're going to be sorry. You're going to be sitting on the bank, and you're not going to be fishing. He told me how to carry that rod. I didn't listen. I'm walking on those railroad tracks, caught that tip, snap, boom. He says, I told you so. And so ever since then, I always carry it the way you described. I've taught my son that. I've taught my grandson that. And yet I see guys going through the bushes with the other way around. And I'm going, I just like shake my head and go, why? Why are these guys doing that? But I guess you got to do it once to learn, right? I did it early on. But
I've had a couple of clients that have broke I've made them the second tip that they broke, and I told them, you break another one, I'm not going to make you another one at any price. It's like these are like my children, and you're molesting my children.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, well, Roger, can I say something for a moment about this series?
Sure. Go right ahead.
This bamboo fly rod making series is a new offering, and we call it a first in class because of the way it is designed. The same videographer, the same producer and director that does our Wild Berries Outdoors, a dude by the name of David Stroman of Atlanta, Georgia, is our producer and director and everything, and the same video techniques and professionalism in our videos, in these eight videos for these steps, are the same ones we use for Wild Berries Outdoors. And then also along with that is the tutorial that comes with each step that tells you task by task exactly how to do it, and then where to get all the materials and tools and plans and everything that you're going to need to make these rods. Everything is in it. And this is going to be available Thanksgiving Eve on wildberries.com And you can, in fact, you can go to wildbearings.com right now and look at a little video we've got in there about the series, or you can go to Wild Bearings Outdoors YouTube channel, and it'll pop up the first thing there if you're interested in seeing any more about this series.
Great, great. That answers all the questions for folks that want to learn more about making bamboo fly rods, and these are the guys to teach how to do that. So, yeah, thanks for doing that series, and I wish you all the best with that. So good luck, and hope you get a lot of subscribers. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Roger. It's been great being with you tonight, and hope you have great holidays along with your listeners and your followers, and it's been fun spending time with you.
Well, good. Well, we got a few more things to do. In fact, giving away that video from your series, so hang tight, guys, and we'll do just that the next few minutes. Just a reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. Now, if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out on some of these great prizes that we give away. If you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show, collect your information, and then so that we can deliver the prize to you. And the first thing we're giving away is a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. And to learn more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org, flyfishersinternational.org. And let me just fire up my database here. And it looks like Jeffrey Shaney in Colorado. So congratulations, Jeffrey. I know you'll enjoy your membership with FFI. And for those that aren't a member and want to join, go to flyfishersinternational.org, flyfishersinternational.org. We're also giving away a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. To learn more about Trout Unlimited, go to tu.org. And the winner for that is going to be Charles Barber in Ohio. So, Charles, congratulations to you as well. And I know you'll enjoy your membership to Trout Unlimited. Okay, so now we're going to give away one of the videos from the 8-part series that Sam and Chris have created. And you'll be able to, what should they do here, Sam? Should they wait until it's advertised on your site so they can decide which video they want to get and then contact you? Is that how you want to do it, or how do you want to give this away?
The offering will go live Thanksgiving Eve. So they're not going to be able to do this until Thanksgiving Eve when it goes live, and they can go on there and decide which one they want. And I guess after the call tonight, Roger, it'd be okay to give this individual my phone number or email address. When they decide, connect us up, and then we'll exchange it that way.
Okay, sounds good. Okay, so the question is, what was the name of the person that Sam learned to make bamboo fly rods from in 1997? This might be too hard, but the other one I have is too easy, so I'm going to give this a shot. So we have to wait a second because there's a delay until people hear the question, and then they got to type in the answer, and then we see if we've got a winner here. Oh, wow. I think we might have the correct answer right at the start. Gary Lacy?
Yeah.
Is that it, Sam? Chris?
Yeah.
That's it.
Okay. Well, first person to answer got it right. Bob Younger in Indianapolis, and Bob has listened to the show for years now. So I'm glad he was able to win that, and I thought, it was going to be too hard, but he's taking good notes. So congratulations, Bob. You know the routine. Actually, I don't need your address, Bob. I've got your email. Send me your phone number so that I can exchange that with Sam, and we'll get you guys connected. Just fill out the same form you just filled in out and put your phone number in there for me, and then we'll get you guys get connected so you can get a copy of that video. So congrats, and thanks for playing. Let's see. Oh, we got another one came in. Correct answer. Steve in California. Yep, so that was it. Yeah, only two people answered that question. I knew it was hard. Anyway, all right. Well,
somebody's listening anyway.
yeah. Well, you know, it's I try to make it difficult at least a little bit so it's not too obvious. So anyway, hey, Sam and Chris, thanks so much for being on the show with us tonight. Really appreciate you taking your time and staying up late there on the East Coast. So, but I appreciate it. And thank you so much for being with me tonight.
Okay, Roger, our pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hopefully you've all found the podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, just look for the link on the top line menu. The archive, you'll find all of our past shows, over 400 and some shows now. You can search by keyword phrase like trout, tarpon, bamboo fly rod making now and so forth. And I'm sure you'll find a show that will surprise you and you'll learn a lot from. Our next broadcast will be on December 4th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern time. And that show I'll be interviewing Bo Beasley, and our show is called Healing Waters. Bo unveils the profound journey of veterans healing through fly fishing. Drawing from his book, Healing Waters, we explore heartfelt stories of recovery from the battlefield to the riverbank and hear how the serenity of casting lines and the camaraderie among veterans nurture both body and soul, offering a powerful testament to the therapeutic wonders of nature. Don't miss this deeply moving episode where every cast brings a step toward healing. To add this to your calendar, just go on our homepage there under Bo's picture. You'll see a add to calendar button there. Click on your favorite calendar, add it to your calendar, and then you'll be all set. I'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics, Watermaster, and the Ugly Bug Fly Shop for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.